Welcome, welcome, welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. It is March 27th, and we're going to be talking about all things artificial intelligence, but it's a very special day. So I want to use some artificial intelligence right now to give a very special wish.
Feliz cumpleaños, Avi. Es tu día. Espero que sea increíble.
In case you don't speak Spanish very well, it said, happy birthday to you, Avi. It's your day. I hope it's amazing.
Thank you, Cherry. It's also Mariah Carey's day.
Oh.
Happy birthday, Mariah Carey.
That's all right. That's a nice person to share a birthday with.
Equal levels of fame between the two of us. So it's really, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And that app I played is a Google Translate app. And we're going to be talking about AI and language.
You just tied it all
translation
together.
Wow. Today.
Yeah, we have a guest, Louise Matsakis, who wrote an article for The Atlantic about whether AI spells the end of language education, because there are so many powerful tools right now that allow us to translate language in real time, and they're only getting more powerful. So do you still need to study, you know, French and Spanish?
I don't know, man. I did that in like literally 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And I was
able to. You put a lot of thought into my birthday gift. Thank you.
But no, I mean, that means that you can travel the world and you don't need to learn the language. What's lost by that? We're going to be talking about that. And if you have questions, have you used one of these AI apps? Are you nervous about people, you know, deciding not to learn?
I want to know if you're a French teacher or a Spanish tutor.
There's a lot in language. So email us, studio2@whyy.org. You can also call 888-477-9499. And we also have the big part of our discussion is a fascinating story about a local doctor who is using artificial intelligence to take old remedies or generic drugs and match them to very rare diseases.
Yeah, such an interesting story. Mm-hmm. His name is Dr. David Fagenbaum, and he was able to treat his own potentially terminal illness by finding a generic drug that doctors didn't even know was going to work to treat his rare disease.
And he's been in remission for over a decade.
Incredible. Yeah. And so now he's thinking, could we use artificial intelligence to match patients like him with these thousands of generic drugs that are floating around out there? And he's got a bunch of money now from the federal government to pursue this idea.
Yeah, you don't want to miss that story. And if you want to email a comment, studio2@whyy.org. And so we're going to jump into the news. Wanted to do an update on that bridge collapse in Baltimore. The 6 construction workers that went missing during that collapse are presumed dead at this point, and that search and rescue mission is now a recovery effort. If you recall, 2 people were rescued. Both seems like they will be okay. And the preliminary investigation obviously shows that the crash was not intentional, and Governor Wes Moore of Maryland says it looks like the vessel lost power. But all of that got our local news media thinking. Yeah. We have quite a few bridges in our area. Could this happen here? We've been told, or it's been reported repeatedly, that from officials from the Delaware River Port Authority, that the bridges in our area have some protections that would prevent a ship from striking the bridge supports directly. And I'll go over a few.
Yeah, sure.
This is just, you know, of course, what they're saying. They said the Betsy Ross Bridge has concrete dolphins, which are these huge structures in the water that provide a barrier between any vessel and the bridge supports. Also, the Commodore Barry has rock islands surrounding their bridge supports. Delaware Memorial Bridge has similar structures. And they've also said that the Walt Whitman and Ben Franklin bridges have support structures that are well out of the reach of the main shipping channel, and that the suspension cables for those bridges are attached to structural steel towers that sit on a foundation. So there's a lot of structures and different things that would prevent, they say, a ship from just striking without some type of barrier preventing that. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you don't think about the redundancies and the safety measures in our built environment until you have to. It is somewhat assuring to hear that there are these types of structures protecting our major bridges. At the same time, we don't exactly know what happened in Baltimore. So, you know, what details come out of that might change the way we evaluate, you know, the safety of our own bridges. But it's certainly something we're thinking about and wondering if we can do more to upgrade the safety of our bridges. There's tons of traffic.
Yeah.
on our rivers, and we're a big port, so it's something we're thinking about.
Yeah, and these type of situations, just like with the I-95 fire and collapse that we had last year, it reminds you of how important these
These
structures and our infrastructure is to just our everyday lives. So,
yeah. Let's stay by the river now in South Philadelphia. FDR Park, which is right up against the wetlands and the river there, the Delaware River, is undergoing a massive $250 million renovation. It's already happening, started a couple years ago. But there was always controversy around this rebuild because part of this park used to be a golf course. And when it was abandoned as part of this phased plan, it sort of grew into a semi-natural meadow space that a lot of people really loved. People actually called it the Meadows. And when they were going through this project to redesign the park, they were always going to knock down what had become the Meadows and put all sorts of stuff there. Some semi-natural wetlands, but also some recreational fields, basketball courts, tennis courts, and a lot of people got really mad about that. Now a group of residents is suing, asking for an injunction, saying that this redesign of the golf course slash meadows is so radical it requires both court and city council approval to move forward. They want an injunction, and the lawyer representing them has been successful with similar lawsuits before. So perhaps, perhaps there will be a pause in this big FDR rebuild if these plaintiffs get their way.
Yeah, and they're citing dozens of acres of artificial turf as the main reason. They say, look, you know, we like the naturalness of this space. We don't want all this artificial turf, and that the city should have been able to, there should have been this fail-safe, this community input. So it's going to be interesting. Those renovations are well underway.
Well underway.
And part of it had already opened to the public, those renovations with the new playground space. We talked about that.
Right.
So we shall see. They want to order blocking that.
Yeah, I wonder what the efficacy of an injunction would be at this point, given that a lot of stuff has already been knocked down. So I don't know. I mean, I can't walk into the construction site, but even if they win, the plaintiffs, I'm not exactly sure what they would achieve, but I guess we'll see when this suit unfurls.
Yeah, and since we've been all over the water recently.
Yes.
Just staying in water. On Monday, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy announced $3.7 million in funding to study the impact of wind farms on whales and other marine mammals. We've been talking about wind farms and offshore wind energy and all those things. And if you remember, a number of whales have been found dead off the Jersey Shore, and people blame those wind shore, those offshore activities related to wind farms. Community members blame that. Of course, scientists said there was no link. Well, now this money will go to hopefully figuring out if there is a link. It's going to go to the state's ongoing research and monitoring initiative, which to date has received about $13 million. It'll support research of offshore wind activities. It will also help the NOAA lead aerial surveys in coastal New Jersey to identify whale activity from New York down to North Carolina. And Rutgers University researchers will also receive funding to use satellite transmitters to track whale behavior. So they're really putting some money into figuring this out.
But just like with the last story, timing is key.
Yeah.
Even if they learn something, these projects are already on the tracks. So what exactly happens if they learn something that contradicts what they already think they know to be true? Not sure.
Yeah.
All right. Cherry started a new tradition last week.
Yeah.
Avi's Tangents.
Okay.
You have no idea what I'm going to say right now.
No idea.
I'm going to cue you up with some music. Let's hear it. Take me out to the ballgame.
Yes.
The Phillies home opener is coming up tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
Weather permitting. Happy opening day, spring excitement, etc.
Go Phils.
So that got me curious. Go Phils. That's right. Go Phils.
It comes back.
I got me curious. What was the first Phillies opening day like? This was 1883. So I looked back in the archives, the newspaper archives. Very disappointing. The article was like this small, and it was just like a chronological account of what happened in the game. No detail, no fanfare. They said there were 1,000 fans there. 1883, Phillies versus the Providence Grays. That was the first Phillies opening day. But it did say something interesting, which is that the game was at a field called Recreation Park.
Oh, where was that?
I had never heard of Recreation Park.
Mm-hmm.
It was in North Philly, 24th and Ridge, basically.
Mm.
Today, it's all paved over. There's like a mini mart there. No plaque, nothing to acknowledge where the first ever Phillies game took place. Isn't that kind of crazy?
Are you going to start? Are you going to like write a letter? Are you going to start a movement here?
Honey? Maybe. I'm thinking about it. But I did also find this very interesting about Recreation Park. So sometimes people think the Philadelphia Phillies is a reference to a horse. Because if you spell Philly with an F, it means a young female horse. But it's not. It's just a reference to people from Philadelphia or something like that. But Recreation Park, before it became the home of the Phillies, it was a horse market.
Wow.
So if you think about it, before there were Philadelphia PH Phillies at Recreation Park, there were Philadelphia F Phillies.
Wow.
How about that? Now, here's my question to you. Should the Phillies incorporate some like horse imagery into like an alternative uniform or into their branding? I think that would be a nice callback to the first place they ever played, which used to be a horse market.
Maybe there was a reason why they moved.
From the original field?
Yeah,
because it was tiny, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of like their red. I kind of like what they have going on now.
You're saying no horse.
I don't know. Like, I mean, I kind of like the Fanatic, you
know? Stick with tradition.
Yeah, I kind of, and the Fanatic might get a little upset you start bringing a horse up in there.
He is very
Philly
prickly.
Philly or not.
He is very prickly.
Okay.
That has been my weekly tangent. The Phillies used to play at a former horse market. Coming up, we're talking about AI and a doctor who found a cure for his rare disease.
Mm-hmm.
Details to come on Studio 2.
Dangerous curves in that beautiful city. Oh, but you never see no warning signs. And if you want to get right down to the nitty gritty, oh, you can bat a thousand every time.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Billions of dollars fund cancer, diabetes, heart disease research, illnesses that affect millions of Americans. But rare diseases don't get that kind of attention and money. To close that gap, physician scientist David Fagenbaum has come up with a solution that uses AI to identify old drugs that could treat these orphan diseases.
Fagenbaum has an incredible personal story of his own, which led him to this idea. He was diagnosed with the rare deadly disease, Castleman disease, and spent years in medical school and after searching for a treatment. He almost died 5 times, but he finally found a generic drug that worked. With thousands of drugs on the market, Fagenbaum believes many could be repurposed for other conditions, and he started a nonprofit. It's called Every Cure, to employ artificial intelligence to find likely matches. David Fagenbaum is here with us in our studio to talk about how his own experience has led him to this new venture. Welcome to Studio 2, David.
Thanks so much for having me.
I know you've told your personal story many times, but for the benefit of our audience, let's go back to when you were in medical school. How did you find out that you had Castleman disease, and what started you on the journey of trying to find your own cure or treatment?
Sure. I was a third-year med student. I wanted to be an oncologist in memory of my mom. She had passed away a few years before, when out of nowhere, I just became critically ill. My liver, my kidneys, my bone marrow, my heart, and my lungs, they all just started to shut down for an unknown cause. So I was, of course, hospitalized and became so sick that a priest read me my last rites when I was 25 years old. Thankfully, we got this diagnosis of Castleman's, and with that came a lot of chemotherapy. But unfortunately, I kept relapsing.
And so you decided that, you know, you got to a critical point and you decided you needed to find your own cure. What was that process like?
That's right. I actually started on an experimental drug. It's the only drug to ever be studied in a clinical trial for my disease. And I'd hoped so badly it would save my life. It would be the cure that we never found for my mom, but maybe that could cure me. And then I relapsed on it and I learned that there were no more drugs in development. There were no more promising leads. And I was just blown away. I was like, wait a minute. there are diseases out there where like we don't have any options left and there's nothing being done, like no research was being done. So for me, I promised my dad, my sisters, and my girlfriend at the time that I'd dedicate the rest of my life to try to find a treatment for me. And I knew I didn't have $1 billion or 10 years to develop some new drug from scratch. If I wanted to survive, I would need to find an existing drug made for another disease and see if it could maybe save my life.
So how do you go about finding that drug? Because I don't even know like how are drugs classified and labeled and who publishes what they do to the body. Like, how do you go about, as a researcher, finding the drug that might be a match for you?
It's a great point. So the data is spread out in so many places, and you're right. It's like, where do I even go? So for me as a med student, I started performing experiments on my own blood samples because we knew so little about Castleman's that started running experiments on my blood samples that led me to believe that one part of the immune system was turned into overdrive. And what was so exciting about that was that there's a drug that turns that part of the immune system off. It's called sirolimus. It's been around for decades for organ transplant rejection patients. So I thought maybe I could try it on myself. You know, this thing's turned on and this drug turns it off. So maybe it'll work.
And you have to convince your doctors that to go along with it?
That's right. Yeah, I had just graduated medical school, but I was not in a position to prescribe it for myself. Yeah. But I did. I turned to my doctors. I shared the data. And you know, I nearly died 5 times and I was running out of time. And so they decided to prescribe it. And it sort of opened up. And I should mention, January marked 10 years that I've been in remission on this drug.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. And so you can imagine the first day of being on this drug, I'm sitting here thinking to myself, wait, this drug was always here, but we didn't know to try it. How many more of these are out there?
And what was interesting about your story is you got lucky.
Yes.
Because you actually had heard about this drug.
Yes.
But most people, it's so many drugs, you might not. So tell us how you knew, you know, even knew that this drug existed, because a lot of people just wouldn't know.
I got so lucky. I mean, I was a third year med student at the University of Pennsylvania down the street. I could store my blood samples in a lab. I could run experiments on my samples. I mean, I was so fortunate to be at that moment in my life. But to your point, I also was very aware of this drug. It's called sirolimus. And I knew that it turned this part of the immune system off already. And so what I want to get us away from is a world where you have to be a third year med student who happens to be, you know, at this place where you can do all these experiments, to creating a world where we are systematically looking for solutions. And I want to share, you know, one way I thought about this, and that's that when my mom was diagnosed with cancer and just before she passed away, and then when I first got sick, I sort of assumed that like they must be looking for drugs for my disease. I had this idea that there was like a they out there where they're like, you know, systematically trying to find drugs for diseases. And then all of a sudden I learned that actually it's a very disparate system like you described. And it's sort of all these people doing random things. And so that's why we created EveryCure, to actually create a they, people who are systematically looking for treatments to help patients across all diseases.
Because before that meant that your doctor had to stumble on something.
Stumble on it. And for some people, they did stumble on it and they survived. And for other people, their doctor didn't stumble on it and they didn't survive.
Mm. Okay, so EveryCure has been up and running.
Yes.
But the news is around you using artificial intelligence to make this process better, more powerful. I too often think that we assume artificial intelligence is like a magic wand. You wave over something and it just makes
it.
Something magical happen. It fixes it. How does artificial intelligence actually work in the scenarios that you're describing?
Sure. So you can think about it. You know, we've been using artificial intelligence for a long time. Think about when you watch Netflix and Netflix says, based on your profile, the shows that you've watched in the past, these are the shows that I think you're going to like. And it turns out Netflix is pretty good, right? It's like, wow, I really like that show. So the algorithm behind that is something called a random forest model. And basically it ingests loads and loads of data to say, I think this is going to work for you based on your profile and the profile of the show. We are doing the exact same thing with medical research. We come up with profiles for drugs and profiles for diseases, and we create matches between them. So we can say, based on the disease that you have, what is the drug, or the equivalent for Netflix would be, what's the show that you might like? And so we're able to use all of the world's knowledge. And that is what sort of is magical about AI, is that when I was finding this drug for me, sirolimus, to save my life, I worked day and night tirelessly for one disease to eventually find one drug. I went through everything in the world about my disease. AI can actually look at everything in the world about every disease and every drug and come up with predictions for us within less than one day, right? And so the scalability actually is pretty magical.
So when you talk about these profiles, I think it's called a predictive efficacy score.
That's right.
What are the inputs to that? Like, what is it looking at in a given drug, and how is it spitting out that score in the end?
Great question. So you can think about it with the drug for my disease. So we discovered that this communication line called mTOR is really activated in Castleman disease. And this drug called sirolimus turns off the activation of mTOR. And so there's a really good linkage between Castleman's, mTOR, and sirolimus because of this data. So what we do through every cure is we get all of the data from the entire world and we structure it. It's called a biomedical knowledge graph, which basically structures all these relationships. This drug hits this protein. This protein is involved in this disease. Mm-hmm. And then the algorithm applies this random forest model, just like Netflix, to come up with a score from 0 to 1 to say, how strong is this link? And we do it for all 3,000 drugs against all 20,000 diseases.
When you say all 3,000 drugs, that's the amount of drugs just floating out there right
now. That's the amount of FDA-approved drugs. There's about 3,000. That's right.
Wow. And I read about an example of someone you helped recently this year. A person from Washington State who had a rare blood disorder. Could you talk about how you were able to help this person? Was AI used? And if it wasn't, how would that have changed the whole process?
Sure. I'd be thrilled to share about Joseph. So we got a phone call a couple months ago about this patient with a rare blood cancer called POEM syndrome. And he was in the intensive care unit in Washington State. And his family reached out. So I reached out to his doctor. His doctor called me back on a Saturday and started discussing the case. And he said, well, we're about to transition Joseph onto hospice tomorrow because he's not going to make it. He's in multi-organ failure. And I asked the doctor about the treatments that were tried. He said, well, I tried this drug, which is used for POEM syndrome. And I said, well, did you try these few other drugs that are often used for a disease like POEMs? It's for multiple myeloma, which is another form of cancer. And he said, no, I didn't try them. They're not made for POEM syndrome, and he's probably going to die in the next day or so. So I think we're just going to transition to hospice. And so within our algorithm, I looked at the scores for these drugs. They all scored very highly. And basically, the reason these drugs scored highly is that POEM syndrome doesn't have any treatments, but POEMs is very similar to multiple myeloma, and these drugs are treatments for multiple myeloma. So the algorithm predicted that these drugs might work for POEM syndrome. So this doctor decided to try these three drugs and really a last-ditch effort for Joseph. And we sort of all were waiting on our seats, on the edge of our seats for the next few days. And we learned that he was taken off of his life support. We learned that he was taken out of the ICU. And just a couple of weeks ago, he was discharged from the hospital.
So how long would that have taken if you didn't have AI to assist?
Not only would it have taken potentially years, I don't even know if it would have happened because POEMs is so rare. You know, hundreds of people are diagnosed every year. I hate to say this, no one cared about POEM syndrome, except for the 600 or so patients diagnosed every year and their families who want to. And in this case, the drug was already made. It was made for a related disease. It wasn't made for POEMs.
When we talk about scale and these rare diseases, as you mentioned, for any individual disease, there aren't that many people affected. But if you add them all up, it's quite a few people, right?
It is. Yeah. The estimate's at about 10,000 rare diseases that affect about 30 million Americans. So right. 1 in 10 of us, each disease is rare. But when you add them up, it's about 1 in 10 Americans.
And it's very hard to scale solutions for that group of people.
Exactly. No one ever studied POEM syndrome because it's sort of, quote unquote, too rare.
I want to talk about the pharma industry. Like, why? I mean, if they have all these drugs, thousands of drugs, you know, that could possibly cure different diseases, why are they not doing this work?
It's because 80% of those 3,000 drugs are already generic, which means that it's not one company making the drug. It's now maybe dozens of companies making an inexpensive version of that drug. So once a drug becomes generic, it really becomes no longer profitable for the drug company. And I hate saying this because it shouldn't be the case. But, you know, once a drug is no longer profitable, a company can't justify spending, you know, between $1 and $10 million to do a clinical trial if they're not going to make any money on the other end. And so we believe that this has to be fixed. And that's why we created EveryCure to say, among the 3,000 drugs, I don't care whether they're profitable or not profitable. If there's people like Joseph that are waiting for a solution, we need to work with everything we have to make sure we get it to them.
So you've gotten this large chunk of money from the government. It's almost $50 million,
that's
right? How does that actually, you already have the tool, the AI, you have an AI tool you're using. How does the money make the tool better or more powerful? Like what are the steps toward, I don't even understand how the money would be used, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, we have a pilot version of this. And we actually have generated a score for every drug versus every disease, but it's a first version of the score. And that happened to be the scores that we used in Joseph's case. But there's a few different things that we need to do to improve the score. So one is the data that goes into the score, and it goes into the algorithm. So the better the data, the more data, the better the algorithm's going to be. So purchasing and licensing data from companies so we can actually get more medical data into our system, that's one. Second is actually refining the algorithm. So out of the, it's 3,000 drugs, 20,000 diseases, which means there's 60 million scores. So out of those 60 million scores, a very, very small percentage, far less than even 1% of those have ever been tested for that particular disease. So it's a purely a prediction, right? So we need to actually be able to validate these predictions. So we need to improve the algorithm. We need to use things in addition to the random forest, like I described, using large language models, which are sort of the, you know, what everyone's talking about with generative AI. So utilizing new algorithms, improve data sets. And then the third piece is humans to continually to refine and improve these systems over and over again.
Because one of the things you talked about in articles I read is that once you find a possible treatment for a rare disorder, the insurance, could be expensive.
Yes.
The insurance might not cover it. And so you still have to do clinical trials.
You have to. Yeah, because these predictions, they're great and they're a great starting place. But you have to prove that it really works for a company, an insurance company, to want to pay for it. And so, yes, when we find things that look promising and our team says, this drug for this disease, arginine for sickle cell disease is one of our top hits right now. The next step is to actually do a clinical trial to prove that it works and then to make sure then people can actually get arginine.
Is there any risk here? Maybe you match a drug to a patient and it makes the condition worse. Because again, you are sort of, you're jumping off the cliff a little bit here.
There's absolutely a risk. You know, in medicine, we make decisions based on the cost benefit. And so we say, okay, for a horrible disease like Castleman disease, my doctors were very willing to try sirolimus in me because I was going to die without treatment.
Right.
When you have a cost-benefit analysis like that, say something like ALS, you're willing to sort of try things where there could be harm.
Mm-hmm.
But in diseases where maybe there isn't such a significant risk of not treating, that's where the risk-benefit profile is a little different. And so we want to focus on the diseases where there are no treatments, where there really are no options, and that if we can help, it would just be transformative for these people. And so we want to start focusing there. There's still risk. You can still make things worse. But by going into areas where there are no other options, I think we have the greatest opportunity for impact.
Potentially, though, is there a way this technology could be harnessed to help people with rare diseases that are not terminal but chronic, cause pain, cause other types of symptoms that really change their lives? Like, could it get to that place, or will this always be too risky, kind of like a path to pursue for those types of ailments?
It's a great question. I think that we are intentionally including all 3,000 drugs and all 20,000 diseases because we really want to democratize this concept of matching drugs that could help you and the disease that you have, regardless of the disease. As an organization, I think early on we want to focus on the most severe because that's where the greatest opportunity for impact is. We want to save as many lives as possible. But we actually also, part of this funding that we're getting from the government is to make every score publicly available.
Right.
So that means every one of these diseases that you described, there'll be a score for all 3,000 drugs against that disease. So anyone can access it and potentially utilize it.
You have a very aggressive timeline because this nearly $50 million is for a 3-year.
That's right.
So what do you talk about this? Walk us through this timeline. I'm like, are you going to be sleeping at all?
No time for sleep. No time
you
for
don't
sleep.
Seem like a big sleep guy in general.
Not a big fan of sleep.
Yeah.
So we've got a really great team. We've got an incredible tech team that's been utilizing AI in drug discovery and drug development for over a decade now. Really leaders in that space. We've got a really amazing medical team, and we've got a great group that's building out our operations. So we've got an awesome team. It's not just me, thankfully. Got an awesome team, an amazing co-founders Grant Mitchell and Tracy Sikora and others. So the first step is to build the world's largest and most comprehensive data set for drug repurposing. And so part of that is licensing data sets. Ideally, it's getting companies to donate data sets to us when possible. But it's really anyone in the healthcare space. And if you're listening and you work in healthcare and you'd be interested in your data helping us to find cures, we want those data sets. So right now it's about gathering and harnessing.
Yeah, where can they go, by the way?
Everycure.org.
Everycure.org. Mm-hmm.
Yes, please do.
Yeah.
Please do. Thank you. And so first part is harness as much data as possible. And that's really the focus of the next year. In parallel for what we have to deliver at the end of the second year is improving these algorithms that we described. So actually generating new AI algorithms, utilizing new approaches so that once we have this full data set by the end of year one, we're applying new algorithms to that data set. By the end of year three, we'll actually utilize these scores. We'll look across all 60 million scores. We'll have a number of medical experts. And so if you work in the pharmaceutical industry and you're interested in joining us, again, go to everycure.org. But year two is about getting pharmaceutical experts, physicians, researchers, looking through our 60 million scores to pick out what are the top 50. And then eventually it's the top 25 drugs for specific diseases that we want to move forward. So the end of year three, our deliverable is to say, U.S. government, these 25 drugs for these 25 diseases, they need to move forward. And I don't care how you do it, but the U.S. government, we got to do this because we got people to help.
Wow.
In your wildest dreams, 5, 10, maybe even 20 years from now, how many patients, let's say, in a given year, do you think could be benefiting from this?
Yeah, my dream is that every year we are unlocking at least 5 new treatments for diseases that didn't have any treatments. And just for perspective, that would make us more productive than every single independent pharmaceutical company in the world. So the average pharmaceutical company, J&J, Merck, Pfizer, they're getting between 3 and 5 new approvals a year. So that's a dream, right? You know, to be on the same level as a large pharmaceutical company, but to not have any commercial interest whatsoever. We're a nonprofit. It's just about helping as many people as possible. So same number of approvals, but to be able to focus fully on impact. So 5 new treatments every year is really what I want us to work towards. It's really ambitious. But if you do that, you're potentially saving millions of lives.
Wow. David, I got to ask you a personal question, because I read that your mom died when you were in college.
That's right.
In your grief, you founded an organization actively moving forward in her memory to help other grieving young people at colleges. And then when you got this disease, you actively found a cure for yourself and now want to help other people. How are you able to transform pain like this into some type of triumph? And where does your fire and desire come from to get all this done?
Well, thanks for mentioning my mom and bringing her up, because so much of this comes from her. She was the most incredible person. I just realized recently that I'm crossing the point where I spent now more than half of my life without her. She passed away when I was 19 years old. During those 19 years, I learned so much from her about grit and fighting back. I watched her battle cancer so gracefully and also with such willpower. So she has been just the role model for me as I've gone through all these challenges. And for me, she was such an amazing person that I felt that her life and her legacy needed to continue on beyond her passing from cancer. So actively moving forward, those were my mom's initials. My mom named Anne Marie Fagenbaum. So this was a way for me to embody her. She was the supporter to everyone. So AMF still lives on. We're still supporting college students all over the country. Most people, or nearly everyone, has no idea that AMF stands for my mom's initials, but she continues on in that way. And this sort of idea of taking a major challenge and then channeling it into something positive is just something that I've personally gotten so much satisfaction out of, being able to see something just horrible and then turn it into something positive. And my mom had a term for this. She would talk about how people often say you should look for a silver lining in the middle of a really tough time. But she would tell me and my sisters, we shouldn't just look for silver linings. We should look to create silver linings. And so it's about, okay, something horrible is happening. Let's create a silver lining so something positive comes out of this horrible thing.
And you, as a teenager, were able to understand that and harness that.
And harness it and put it right here in my heart and keep it with me.
Because I wonder if you hadn't gotten sick, right? If you hadn't had that tough time, would, you know, the gentleman in Washington State have be out of ICU living his life right now?
No, and that's both so tragic to think about. You know, if these things hadn't happened, people would be suffering or wouldn't be here. It's also, in my opinion, just such a responsibility. You know, that these people are out there waiting. We had a meeting right before this, and on this call, it's our medical team where we're talking about specific drugs for specific diseases, and these patients are waiting, and the drug is already there. It's already at your neighborhood CVS. We just need to make the match to get that drug from the CVS into that patient to save their life.
So there's this urgency.
Such an urgency.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Just as we wind down, just a minute left, I am curious more generally where you see AI being most useful in the medical field, outside of just your own pursuits. I mean, do you have a lot of faith that this technology is going to transform medicine?
Yeah, absolutely. I think obviously you've heard why I'm so excited about it in this world of matching drugs and diseases. I think this is an incredible use case for AI that's going to be so transformative. I really also think in the diagnostic side of things, it's going to be incredible. I've seen with my own eyes a 60-page set of medical records entered into an algorithm and into a system, and then a diagnosis coming out of it within seconds. And the diagnosis wasn't in the 60 pages. It was just, this is everything that's going on with this patient, and then a diagnosis came out that's correct and within seconds. And so that's the kind of thing that humans can do, but that takes a lot of time for a human to do. The fact that you can do that in seconds, I think that's going to be transformative.
That is the voice of Dr. David Fagenbaum, co-founder and president of Every Cure and a physician scientist at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for being with us today on Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
We loved having you. And coming up,
more AI.
More AI. Do AI language apps, do they spell the end to foreign language education? Will you give up that French class and instead use a translation app? We'll see.
You might. Email us, studio2 at whyy.org with your thoughts.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Bonjour. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Oh, I love that.
There are over 7,000 known and spoken languages in the world, far too many to study them all. I can't even nail French. But that's not going to stop you from speaking or understanding these languages.
Yes, Avi, with artificial intelligence becoming more advanced, you can translate almost any language you want, allowing you to communicate globally or watch movies in foreign languages, which I do all the time. So the question is, why bother studying languages anymore?
Cherry, there is someone who had the same question you just posed. Louise Matsakis, studying Mandarin for years, she was frustrated after she realized she could create a so-called deepfake video of herself talking proper Mandarin.
你好，我叫路易斯·马萨基斯，我是一名记者，我撰写有关科技和中国的文章。 我于2016年从纽约大学毕业后开始了我的职业生涯。
I'm sure you noticed there, no accent, no grammar mistakes, I'm told. So Louise, who is a journalist, did what every journalist would do. She wrote an article about it.
Yeah, and Louise is joining us now to talk about the end of foreign language education. She just wrote about it in The Atlantic. Louise, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
And before we get going, we want you to join the conversation. What are the benefits of AI? How many languages do you speak and why? Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Louise, we are fascinated by this topic, but first I have to ask you, the clip that we just heard of you speaking in Mandarin, what did you say and how did you create that clip?
So I'm basically just introducing myself. So I say, hi, my name is Louise Matsakis. I talk about how I'm a journalist. And I sort of end by saying my favorite food is sushi. and I wanted to do something relatively simple that I knew I would be able to sort of evaluate, you know, with my actual human skills. So the way that I created it was using software from a new artificial intelligence startup called HeyGen. So all I did was I uploaded a selfie of myself, so just, you know, a static photo, and then I wrote that script in English, and I was able to animate the photo. So now it's a video of, you know, me, quote unquote, speaking in Mandarin. So it's not my voice, but, you know, I think to the average person, it would be sort of unclear. You know, it seems a little bit robotic, but this tech is getting better really, really quickly. So I think, you know, within a year or two, it would be a lot harder to distinguish whether or not that was actually a person speaking in that video.
So I gotta say, Louise, that sounds pretty cool. And I want you to zoom out into the world of AI and language translation. What's out there and how good are these apps right now?
Yeah, so I think anybody that's, you know, maybe taken a trip abroad or tried to talk to a relative who speaks another language is familiar with Google Translate, right? It's been around for 17 years now. But in the last few years, this tech has gotten much better. So this technology called neural networks, which is the same thing that powers ChatGPT and other chatbots like that, has been used to improve machine translation. So now, Spotify is using it to translate podcasts. Samsung's new phone apparently can translate conversations, phone calls in real time. I think one of my favorite examples was from the gaming platform Roblox, which is now automatically translating conversations between users on the gaming platform. And what they said in their blog post was that, one user who speaks English might not even realize that their conversation partner is actually in South Korea.
Yeah, you mentioned that real-time translation with Roblox, Samsung. How good is that right now? Because that to me would seem like the hardest hill to climb, to make something that would allow you to have a real-time in-person or over-the-phone interaction. How good is that? How much better is it going to get?
So I would say right now that with audio and video, there still is a little bit of a lag. It's definitely gotten much shorter and the quality of the translation has really improved. But with text, with that Roblox example where it's a text chat, I would say it's gotten, close to instantaneous.
Wow.
That doesn't mean that there's still not a lot of mistakes or that, things are not lost in translation, but this technology has rapidly improved.
Yeah, I've used Zoom and it has a auto translation feature that's pretty automatic. There is a delay, but it's pretty good. So I want to talk about like the uses for this and the impact of it. How are people using these apps and is it impacting, and I think you make the argument that it's impacting that their desire to want to learn a language in real life.
So a few examples that I think are maybe worth mentioning are that influencers on social media are using this tech to translate their videos. So, a musician might translate their song automatically so they can start reaching, audiences in different countries. Couples are using it to fall in love. And while I think it's not necessarily clear that this technology is, the exact reason that less people are choosing to learn foreign languages, at least in, a number of Western countries, but it's definitely getting better at the same time, right? So these two trends are happening simultaneously, and I think looking at them both is really interesting.
Yeah, so we'll talk downsides in a second, but upsides, I'm going to read in this email from listener Sammy, who says, as a lifelong Trekkie, I've been looking forward to a quote, universal translator for a while. Communication is key in so many areas. I won't go into the Star Trek example, but you do mention it, I believe, in your story.
I do, yeah.
this could be a great, excuse me, this could be a great democratizer, right? This someone in a country who has, less access to formal education. Maybe could compete for a job they couldn't compete with someone with before, or an immigrant to a country who doesn't speak the language might be able to have access to certain parts of the labor force that before were closed off to them as they were making their transition. I mean, does seem like there's a quite a bit of upside here, is there not?
There absolutely is a ton of upsides. I think, especially like you said, sort of in business context and also in personal context, a grandmother being able to write a letter to their grandchild, even if they don't share a same language, right? Being able to interpret maybe what your relative said, decades ago or what they wrote in their diaries. There's a lot of uses that I think are really profound and really impactful. But yeah, I also worry about what is lost when we rely on this technology. And I've sort of seen it in my own, professional life as well. The example you used of like, trying to get a job in a foreign country. Well, I've used this technology, as sort of a first step in interpreting what's going on in the Chinese internet or trying to see what, professionals there are talking about, right? And while I can sort of get a literal interpretation of what they're saying, I've found repeatedly that it's not enough to actually have, I think, that level of insight of a colleague who could contribute to the organization in the same way if they shared the same language.
And by the way, Molly says via email, as a Spanish language teacher for over a decade, I fear the rise of AI to box teachers like me and my colleagues out of the profession. One thing, however, that AI cannot translate is the cultural bridge that language learning creates. Are there upsides to actually learning the language?
I think there are definitely upsides. There are things you can't really access unless you actually can sort of like see what's happening in the language, saying, oh, the way that Spanish considers time or the way they, portray familial relationships or the way that gender is interpreted, I think, you know, gives you a layer of access to how that culture thinks that is really hard to get if you're just translating everything. But I also want to speak to that teacher's point about focusing on the cultural competency. You know, the reality is probably most of her students are not going to get to the level of fluency where you can sort of see those nuances between different languages. And I would love for more teachers to say, okay, you know, we're going to spend maybe a little bit less time on these grammar drills, but you know, when we talk about the vocabulary for, you know, housing in Spain, we're also going to talk about like, what is the system for government housing there? How does rent work? How do they, you know, think about, you know, the public good? How are housing structures, you know, thought about in terms of like the city landscape, right? Like, I think if we put more emphasis on those things, that will give more students the skills they need. And maybe, you know, they can rely on an AI to ensure that, you know, their sentences or their email to that Spanish colleague is, you know, good enough that the colleague will understand what they're saying.
Potentially just shift the focus, not end the class or the pursuit altogether. I want to bring in another email now from Catherine, who says, the pleasure of learning and knowing other languages is delightful. It helps open my mind to new ideas and also connect words from other languages with my first language, English. And I want to use that to ask you, Louise, are there neurological benefits just to the activity of learning a new language, even if you don't need it in sort of a real world sense, the fact that you're putting your brain through that rigorous exercise, does that help your brain?
The answer is absolutely. So a number of fairly rigorous studies have shown that being bilingual might actually help you stave off dementia. And studies have also shown that the brains of people who are bilingual have more neuroplasticity. So, you know, this is still a developing research area, but I think that the evidence so far is very strong to suggest that learning another language is helpful in terms of just sort of your overall cognitive function.
I wonder about what would happen if we just stopped learning these languages. And I fear sometimes that we become so dependent on technology that if it was taken away, we'd be lost without it, right? So what are some of the downsides if would some of these languages fade away, or does AI actually help us keep languages that would otherwise be gone?
I think the answer is probably yes and yes. I think it's definitely possible that this sort of technology could help preserve rare languages. You know, we're seeing a lot of instances where this technology is being used to create language learning apps for languages that are less widely spoken, which in the AI field they often refer to as lower resource, meaning there's less data in those languages on the internet. You know, things like Swahili or Urdu, you know, compared to high resource languages like English or Chinese or Spanish. So I think on one hand, you know, perhaps it helps us preserve some of the language diversity. But on the other hand, I worry about sort of like the interconnections between those different language communities. And if there's less need for human translators, or we put less value on that labor, which is a very, you know, highly specific, highly skilled, subjective, you know, just to give you a brief example that I think is really illustrative is, you know, again, I often report on China, and Chinese is full of idioms, you know, and it's, you know, the sort of phrases like two birds with one stone, right, that we also have in English. And sometimes what I see is because, you know, news reporters or just people on social media are relying on Google Translate, they translate those idioms literally.
Right. And they're, right? They're totally missing the point.
Yeah, exactly. Or it just seems like, you know, people in China are using these like strange, like ancient phrases in a way that I think exoticizes instead of brings people closer together. Right.
Go ahead.
And there's no correct way, right, to translate those. You have to sort of interpret them in the best you can. And I worry about like, what happens when AI decides, okay, this is the way we're going to translate this idiom into English, right? And is that really fair? Or is that the right way? No, the answer is it's up for debate, right? Yeah. It's an art.
And Thomas via email says there are also tonal inflections that you might miss if you really aren't immersed in the language, talking specifically about Chinese. So much to this topic. We do have to end the conversation there. but it's not the last time we're going to be talking about this, I predict. That's Louise Matsakis, a freelance journalist who recently wrote a fascinating story for The Atlantic about AI and the future of language study. Louise, thanks for being with us on Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
It was all AI today on your birthday, by the
on
way.
On my birthday. And Allen Iverson is one of my favorite basketball players. So there's
the
a
other
match.
AI. The other AI. And that, friends, wraps up our show. Got to thank our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered today. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philly, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. We'll talk to you tomorrow for a very special show. You don't want to miss it.